I'm Jeff Sickinga, Executive Director of the Ashbrook Center, and this is The American Idea, where we discuss the ideas, people, and events that have made America what it is today. We believe that by understanding our history and our principles, we can better live up to the promise of the American founding and preserve our ongoing experiment in self-government. Welcome to The American Idea.
Welcome, everyone, to this episode of The American Idea. Today, we're going to be talking, I think this is a controversial thesis, an argument that we're going to have about the American founding, and particularly about the influence of the second president of the United States, John Adams, in shaping the presidential office. Much written about, HBO miniseries about. But our guest today argues that John Adams has been misunderstood and I think underappreciated for his role in shaping the American presidency. I'm joined for the conversation today by Dr. Lindsay Chervinsky. Lindsay is Executive Director of the George Washington Presidential Library at the wonderful Mount Vernon. So highly recommended to our listeners. I hope everyone's been. Every American should visit Mount Vernon. It's sacred ground to those of us who love American history and the founding, but it's also just a terrific place to visit. The Presidential Library is fantastic. It is really, really a first-rate facility with first-rate people running it. We are delighted to have Lindsay with us today. She's a presidential historian who received her bachelor's from, appropriately enough, George Washington University, and her graduate degrees, including PhD from the University of California at Davis. She is a widely published author in addition to her responsibilities at the Presidential Library. Several books should deserve mention. One is called The Cabinet, George Washington and the Creation of American Institution. That received very high praise from a number of important scholars and organizations devoted to the American founding. Terrific study of the formation of the presidential cabinet. Another wonderful book from University of Virginia Press called Mourning the Presidents, Loss and Legacy in American Culture. And of course, the book that's the topic of our conversation today, which I want to highly recommend to all of our listeners. If you care about the American founding, if you care about the presidency, you're going to want to read this book. It's called Making the Presidency, John Adams and the Precedents That Forged the Republic. Dr. Lindsay Chervinsky, thank you for taking the time to join us on The American Idea.
Well, thank you so much for having me. I really appreciate that kind introduction.
Boy, reading into this book of yours, I'm struck by, I don't think it's too much to say, it's a controversial thesis. The thesis that Adams' leadership and John Adams' legacy profoundly helped to define the office of president. It's not the kind of thing that you hear very often.
No, it's not, which is always, a good opening then for a new book or for a new scholarly argument. As you said, my first book was on Washington, and I wrote about how he had created so much of the presidency, in particular the cabinet, really around his own presidential leadership methods and styles and preferences. And because so little was actually written down in the Constitution, it gave him so much space to fill out the fuzzy bits of the presidency that, really that are built on practice and governing in real time. But the thing about Washington was that he was so unique and so unparalleled in his stature and his reputation, in the sort of public love and adoration for him, that his power was often unquestioned and his decisions were very rarely checked in the way that any other presidents would be. And so I got to the end of his presidency and I started thinking, like, how does this institution actually work for anyone else, for a mere mortal who's in this office? And that was my starting point as a question about how John Adams took what Washington had established and then tried to make it work for anyone else. But what I realized as I was doing this work is so many of the fantastic biographers of John Adams, of which there are many, really treat the presidency as the low point. And I think that's because of the moments that they lived through. You know, so much of the history we write depends on the questions we ask, because that informs and shapes what sources we're looking at, how we're looking at them, how we're evaluating them. And because those biographies were written prior to our current moment and prior to seeing a contested transition, I think they just took that for granted a little bit. And I don't blame them. I certainly did too. But seeing those events take place caused me to want to have a better understanding about where things like the peaceful transfer of power started. And if you're asking about that, it's really hard to not appreciate John Adams.
One of the interesting arguments that you make in appreciation of John Adams, and I thought, boy, I had to really kind of stop when I read this and thought, that does seem right. I never thought of that, which is you argue that John Adams is actually one of the most qualified people to become president, even though he had not held an executive position in the way that we normally think about that. Can you talk a little bit about John Adams, especially for some of our listeners who may not know so much about the man himself, before he becomes president? Why do you argue he was so well qualified?
Well, John Adams was a lawyer. He went to Harvard and then read law, and he had worked as a lawyer in Massachusetts for many years before gaining his first amount of sort of national fame, or maybe we should say continental fame, because the nation didn't exist yet, as the lawyer for the British soldiers that were accused in the Boston Massacre. And that was really important for him because he wanted to demonstrate that this resistance, this independence movement, was one that was built on the rule of law and was not built on the passion of mobs. So that was when he first kind of becomes famous. Then he was a delegate to the Continental Congress. He was on more committees than anybody while he was in Congress. He was sort of indefatigable when he was there. He then, after serving in Congress, they sent him to Europe, and he served stints in France, Great Britain, and The Hague. He was responsible for a number of really critical treaties and trade relationships, especially with the Netherlands, but was also an essential voice in the Treaty of Paris that ended the Revolutionary War and indeed guaranteed American independence. In between that period of time, he also drafted the Massachusetts State Constitution, which is the longest surviving written constitution in the world and served as a model for the U.S. Constitution. And then, of course, he was vice president for 8 years under Washington. And as you said, he didn't have an executive position, which turned out to be a pretty significant flaw. But when it comes to the presidency, especially in the early republic, understanding of foreign policy is so essential, because foreign policy is the majority of the president's portfolio. And of course, the president is the only person really responsible for foreign policy. So when it came to that knowledge and expertise, no one had more than John Adams did.
It also seems to me, and that, I think that's a very important point, because it also seems to me that even if you think about his time in the Second Continental Congress or during the course of the American Revolution, he seems like he's one of the persistent voices saying to Congress, we have to get our act together. We have to properly fund the Continental Army. Executive leadership is really important here. We have to help out George Washington in the field. Over and over and over again, he's lamenting the fact that Congress isn't taking Washington's leadership and command of the army and the necessity of victory in the armed struggle seriously enough.
Absolutely. I mean, he, you know, for all of the criticism that I think he gets in American history, and, you know, when we think of his legacy, and maybe we can circle back to why we remember him the way that we do, because I think it's quite interesting. Turns out that more often than not, his judgment actually proved to be quite sound. And that was true when it came to the importance of executive power in Congress. It was true when it came to the importance of funding the new government and its army. It was true when it came to the importance of neutrality in the 1790s and how to pursue foreign policy. So I think that what his time in service taught him was both, you know, men can be quite difficult and they can't always be trusted to do the right thing. And he had what we might consider to be sort of a realpolitik vision of foreign policy, and so that nations would do what was in their best interests, and so should the United States.
Can you talk a little bit more about the sort of the political thought? He wrote a work of political thought, The Defense of the Constitutions of Government of the United States, one of the few founders to write a kind of full, comprehensive political theory. What kind, say more about the political ideas, political principles, political theory that Adams brought with him to the presidency?
Adams was incredibly well-read. He would often write in his diary, he would write about his farm activities during the day and include some really hilarious descriptions of like the worms he was finding in his corn. And he would gender them, which I think is hilarious because I don't know how you determine the gender of a worm, but nonetheless, he was quite descriptive. And then he would write about going home, you know, at the end of the day and read which volume of Cicero he was reading. So this was a man of many interests and many passions. He was deeply and widely read, and I think probably the only person that could give him a run for his money in terms of his reading on constitutional ideas was James Madison. Certainly Thomas Jefferson was very broadly read, but I think in terms of like political theory, Adams probably could go toe to toe with Madison better than anyone. And I think he certainly embraced and took in all of the Enlightenment ideas and history. And so he had an understanding of how history had gone and how it had unfolded. I think his vision of the world and his vision of what republics typically did, which is fail, very much shaped his approach to governing and shaped his approach to understanding of governments. You know, I think he probably mostly agreed with the Hobbesian view that, what is it, life is short and brutish, or mankind is short and brutish. I always get this, I butcher this
quote. I think
quote,
it's solitary, poor, nasty, brutish, and short.
I think he would have agreed with that, although, of course, his life was quite long and extraordinary. But which is all which is to say, he sort of had a negative view of mankind, but he didn't actually cause that. That didn't cause him to be pessimistic. It more just caused him to be what I would consider to be very rational and very realistic. And so, for example, to contrast, which I think might be helpful, Thomas Jefferson came away from his time in Europe thinking that the United States was different, that it was sort of a form of American exceptionalism before we really used that language, and that the United States provided an opportunity and Americans were uniquely suited to have a more virtuous, more moralistic society, and therefore the government could reflect that they were a more virtuous people. And John Adams said, no, we just haven't been around as long as Europe. Like, if you give us a couple of centuries, we'll be just as corrupt. Our cities will be just as dirty and vile, and we will be just as venal in our activities. And so they were coming at a similar problem from a very different perspective. And so I think what that meant, and I want to make sure I don't make him seem too dark and serious, because he also was deeply patriotic and believed fervently in the Union and this experiment. It was a family project. The entire family for generations were committed to the success of this project. And which is one of the reasons there's actually an Adams Commission in Congress right now to try and get a Adams family memorial. And I think that is very well suited, because was very much a family commitment. So I don't want my, you know, sort of view of him as being a pessimistic person to make it seem like he was dark, because he also did believe that what the country was doing was extraordinary, and he was very proud to be a part of it.
So he comes into the presidency as a committed small R Republican. He believes in the Republican cause, the cause of republics. He believes in, I think, as the Massachusetts Constitution talks about, the natural rights of mankind and the American Revolution in favor of those. But he's a realist, as you say, understanding that political problems are persistent. They persist over time, and America hasn't escaped the permanent political problems. So he is interesting, as you say, a mixture of optimism and hope for the future with a kind of strain of realism. He goes overseas, as you said, he gains foreign policy experience. Then he becomes George Washington's vice president for 8 years. Talk to us about how that experience as vice president shaped him.
Well, John Adams said that the vice presidency was the most irrelevant office ever created by man, which is actually not the worst thing that vice presidents have said about the job, but it's pretty close. And I don't think that there is a position that was probably worse suited for John Adams than the vice presidency as it worked in 1789 through 1797, which was that he had almost no role. Washington very much kept him at arm's length, did not invite him to a single cabinet meeting, so he was not a part of the governing structure or decision-making process in any way. He did attend a lot of...
Can I just say, I think our listeners would be very surprised to hear that. They would think that Washington and Adams were both Federalists, or at least labeled that. They were simpatico. They had known each other before. And they would wonder, why would George Washington have excluded the vice president from his cabinet?
It's a great question. And we don't really have a firm answer because Washington didn't write it down. But my best guess, my sort of informed speculation, if you will, is that I think he and John were never particularly close. They had been close-ish at the very beginning of the Continental Congress because Adams was actually instrumental in securing Washington's nomination as commander-in-chief of the Continental Army. But then he had criticized some of Washington's decisions in 1776, and I think probably rightfully so. But that criticism got back to Washington, and he did not like public criticism very much. So that sort of led to a little bit of frostiness. And then early on in Washington's presidency, Adams had suggested a more robust and slightly ostentatious title for the president. And that was based on his experience in Europe and a fear that foreign dignitaries would come to the United States and think, you know, what is this podunk backwater nothing nation? And if you had a fancier title, maybe it would instill some respect by both domestic citizens and foreign visitors. That was a very unpopular suggestion, and Adams was met with a lot of ridicule as a result. And so I think that it caused Washington to not really trust his political judgment. And so I think he then kept him at arm's length from that point forward, because prior to that, he had asked for advice and had sent him some letters, and they had talked through some things. Now, that doesn't mean that they didn't see each other, because Washington hosted social events, a series of different social events that were increasingly exclusive, depending on what the event was, at his house, sometimes several times per week. So in any given week, Adams could actually be at the president's house up to three times for a social event. But typically, they were not discussing matters of governance or state. And so he was able to sort of stay informed by reading the newspapers and by listening to what was going on at social activities and in Congress, but that was the extent of his knowledge. And so instead, he just was bored and frustrated for 8 years and would spend a lot of time at the local French bookstore because they had books in tons of different languages and he could try and stay intellectually stimulated.
Then he decides, though, to run for president. Tell us about that first, his decision to become chief executive.
Well, he doesn't so much as try to become president as he's sort of tapped by the Federalist leaders. So at this point in 1796, there were the very beginnings of the first two political parties. They were sort of baby parties, if you will. And the leaders of the Federalist Party gathered in what was called a caucus, and not like we would consider to be an official caucus, but they would sort of gather at one residence, and they selected Adams as the most sensible heir to Washington. He was closest in terms of constitutional structure to Washington. He had a lot of national recognition because of his diplomatic service and his time as vice president. He was very experienced at this really important part of the presidency, and that was something that people took really seriously at that point. And I think it was helpful that he was a Northerner, because they were trying to kind of provide some balance, and they had had a Virginian president, and now they were going to have a Northern president. So he was sort of tapped to run, but he didn't do anything. In the fall of 1796, he stayed home, and he did not even discuss the election until almost right before voting commenced, when he wrote to his son about it. So at this point, it was expected that you would sort of be selected by your fellow citizens, and you would agree to serve on their behalf once called to do so.
Before we continue with our conversation, I think it's important to take a moment and tell you about our undergraduate honors program in the liberal arts here at Ashland University.
Hi, I'm Rich Police, Associate Director of Student Programs at the Ashbrook Center. The Ashbrook Scholar Program is an honors program located at Ashland University for undergraduate students with an interest in politics, history, and economics. Modeled after a classical liberal education, you will read the great texts, not textbooks. Your classes will be conversations, not lectures. Conversations with other students, with your professors, and with great thinkers and statesmen from throughout human history. If you or a young person you know are passionate about life's important questions, if you want an education that emphasizes discovery, if you value liberal education and the principles of freedom it upholds, then this is the place for you. To learn more, visit us online at ashbrookscholar.org.
His rival Thomas Jefferson, and the friendship and rivalry, and then perhaps friendship again between them, has been so well documented. Once Adams becomes president, and he's had the experience of seeing Washington assemble a cabinet, how does he go about constructing his administration? Because in the book, one of the things that you talk about are some of the unique challenges that John Adams faced as president, both externally and internally, including in his own cabinet.
Yes, I think John Adams would have really benefited from having sat in on a cabinet meeting. It would have really helped him have a better understanding of how that institution worked. And the way that it worked is that it depended a great deal on the interpersonal relationships between the president and the secretaries. And it required a lot of maintenance of, you know, Washington was very careful to delegate, but he also then kept a close eye on what people were doing. Adams initially really wanted to have sort of a bipartisan administration and include Jefferson in his decision-making process, but that quickly soured when it became clear that the rest of the Federalists in his administration would not permit that, and that Jefferson was less than willing. One of the challenges that Adams faced was he only had one model, and that was Washington's model. And if he diverged from that, he could be criticized from thinking that he knew better than Washington. And if he adhered to that, he could be criticized for, you know, not adhering to it closely enough or falling short of Washington's, you know, very glorious reputation. And so he was often stuck between a rock and a hard place. And particularly when it came to his cabinet, that was true because he knew that Washington had had a lot of trouble filling vacancies in the cabinet. They were not particularly prestigious positions at the time. He didn't have any model of replacing the secretaries because there wasn't that expectation that secretaries at the time would give former resignations. He didn't have any reason to dislike the secretaries per se. He thought they would be loyal to the office. And of course, he didn't want to seem to be criticizing Washington's choices. So he kept all of Washington's cabinet secretaries. And a spoiler alert, that does not go well for him. And the cabinet turns out to be really the thorn in his side for most of his presidency. And a lot of his successors learned from this example and almost always pull in their own secretaries because it's so important to surround yourself with your own people.
So in a certain way, again, the book talks about how he shaped the office in a certain way. He shaped it in that respect, in a negative respect, which is he didn't do something and his successors learned you need to have your own people in the cabinet as cabinet secretaries. Can you talk a little bit more, as you do in the book, about some of the ways, the positive ways in which Adams continued Washington's process of shaping the presidency, so much of which is just conventional, not laid out in law, not laid out in the Constitution? How did Adams positively shape the presidency?
Well, you're so right. I mean, even today, we often realize that so many things we expect the president to do are just that, they're expectations, and they're not enforced in any way through statute or through the Constitution. But that was especially true in the very beginning when there was even less written down. And so, you know, I think Adams' first big contribution is demonstrating that someone else could do the job, because everyone understood that whoever came second was going to have a terrible time. And he showed up knowing that and willing to be unpopular and do it anyway. And that was a massive contribution because a lot of the American people genuinely weren't sure if the institution would work with someone else in it. So that really can't be overlooked, even if it's sort of hard to quantify. And it's certainly not the type of thing that typically gets you a statue.
I would say it's no small thing. I think there's even a song in the Alexander Hamilton musical that the King George III.
Yes, it references that.
How could John Adams ever replace George?
Yes, exactly. No, I think that's just right. And it wasn't a small thing. The next big piece is he really fought tooth and nail with his cabinet to defend the executive the character of the executive as Washington had established it. So Washington had established the president as being the individual solely in charge of the entire executive branch and the main person in charge of establishing, especially foreign policy, but also response to domestic crises. Adams's cabinet, or most of the cabinet, really fought to have more institutional power for themselves, almost like an executive by committee, or as we might think of like the British cabinet today, where you have a prime minister who's sort of the first, but among equals. And so Adams' cabinet was fighting him over who was going to have the power to make decisions, especially over foreign policy. And so he waged a several-year war to make sure that the president was that person, that the president was the one that established foreign policy. The secretaries did not have a right to do so or to pursue their own agenda. And that culminated in the firing of Timothy Pickering, who was the Secretary of State, in May of 1800. And that was essential because Washington had never fired anybody. When he was displeased with someone, they were so horrified that they would just quit. And so the question of how do you remove a secretary was a live one. It's not mentioned in the Constitution, and the statutes that created this, the executive departments, did not specify because Congress could not come to an agreement. And so it literally was an open question. And so when Adams fired Pickering and then appointed John Marshall as his replacement and the Senate accepted that replacement, they were agreeing that the president had the right to do this. And this right really is fundamental to that character piece, because if a president can't remove a secretary for pursuing their own agenda, then they can pursue their own agenda. And so that right actually was confirmed by the Supreme Court in 1926, but Adams was the one that actually tested that power. And then the last piece, which I think is quite essential, is Adams lost and he went home. And he established in the transition a model for what a transition should be, and that he was incredibly helpful to Jefferson. He instructed his cabinet to be helpful, and he did everything in his power to, I think, not be a distraction, to not make the constitutional crisis worse, and then to get out of the way. And this is in the age of Napoleon. So just for context, not everyone loses and goes home.
Incredibly important, as I think we often think, because Jefferson assumes power, and many of our listeners will have read Jefferson's first inaugural, where he extends the olive branch, right, to Federalists and Republicans together, calls all of us brethren of the same principle. I think we think that, oh, it's Jefferson being magnanimous that helps the transfer of power. And we forget just what you said, the importance of Adams in that.
Yes, absolutely. I mean, and I do give credit to Jefferson for using that language. Now we sort of expect presidents to do that in their inaugural addresses, but he was really the first. But he was really following the tone that Adams had already set for him when he made that very famous address.
In Adams' desire to maintain what Federalist 70 would have called an energetic executive, a person in charge of the executive branch, in charge of foreign policy, responding to domestic crises, desire to continue that and keep that and even strengthen that, it must have led to some interesting moments in his relations with Congress.
Yes, it did. You know, and it's interesting because for most of his presidency, Federalists had control of Congress. So we often think that if a president has, if their party has control over the houses, then it will just be smooth sailing. But because there was a very significant division between the more moderate wing of the Federalist Party and the Arch Federalists, which were the more extreme wing, it led to a lot of conflict between Adams, who was more moderate, and his Arch Federalist nemesis, both in the cabinet and in the Senate. And in particular, this was over foreign policy, about whether or not Adams could send another peace commission to France to try and resolve the what's called the quasi-war, which was sort of a pseudo-naval war-ish, but undeclared, between the United States and France. And Adams was trying to resolve it through diplomacy. And the Federalists really wanted to keep the army that they had built up and were basically using as a spoil system for the Federalist Party. And they didn't want him to pursue diplomacy because they understood that it would hurt their electoral prospects. And so there was a squabble over whether or not Adams could send this peace commission. And they basically ended on sort of a compromise in that Adams would make the Peace Commission a three-person commission instead of a one-person and would include more quote-unquote reliable Federalists. But there was a lot of back and forth over whether or not he had the right to do so.
I think a lot of our listeners would say any study of the Adams and the making of the presidency, in particular his relations with Congress, would be dramatically incomplete if we didn't discuss the Alien and Sedition Acts. Mm-hmm. There have been people, including guests on this podcast, who have argued that was the lowest of low moments for John Adams. Tell us about his signing of the Alien Sedition Acts, what he thought of them, what he didn't think of them, and whether that has been a fair criticism or not.
Well, I do think that it is probably the lowest point of his presidency, but I also think that he gets more blame than perhaps he deserves. And the context for how those laws came about is very important in understanding where to apportion that blame. So first, at that time, the president wasn't really responsible for initiating legislation. It's not like today where the president is often, you know, the moving force behind a legislative agenda. At that time, it was really the movers and shakers in Congress that initiated legislation and got it passed. And so that was true of all four. The Alien Sedition Acts are actually four acts: a Naturalization Act, two Alien Acts, and a Sedition Act. Adams didn't ask for any of them. He did not whip votes for any of them. He did not try and, you know, curry favor for any of them, but he did sign them. However, he treated them differently, and that's also worth noting. So the Naturalization Act made it harder for people to become citizens. This was overtly political because immigrants tended to vote for Democratic Republicans, and the Federalists didn't like that, so they made it harder to become citizens. The Alien Acts, there were two of them. So there's the Alien Friends Act, which is the more extreme version. And the Alien Friends Act was pushed through by Federalists, and it basically gave the president unfettered power to deport people at will. There was almost no check on this power. Adams did not use that power. So he signed the bill, but he never used it. So I think that's a very important notation. The Alien Enemy Act was actually a bipartisan bill that was put forward by the Democratic Republicans to try and stave off the more extreme version. And it was seen as a very reasonable compromise as a war measure because it required a declaration of war. Now, because there was no declaration of war, no one was ever deported. So both of those Alien Enemies Acts, while we can sort of assess them in a theoretical fashion, Adams never used the power that was given to him. And I think that's important. The last bill is really where he gets the criticism, and this is the sedition bill. And to be sure, it was very much political in nature. It was designed to target the Democratic Republican press, in particular those that were critical of Adams and the Federalists in Congress. While he did not, you know, encourage it, he did sign it, and he didn't mind some of the prosecutions, especially of people who had been quite critical of him. That being said, I think one piece of context is worth noting, and that is at the time, today, you know, we recognize that there are limitations on our First Amendment rights. You're not allowed to shout fire in a crowded theater. You know, speech that intentionally provokes violence is not protected under our First Amendment rights, and we have carved out those exceptions through a lot of jurisprudence. None of that was on the books at the time. And so editors were calling for violence in newspapers, and there was violence. So people responded to these newspaper articles by marching through the streets, by beating up other newspaper editors, by, you know, starting fires. I mean, it was a very violent time. And so the one caution that I think is really important from this moment is they genuinely did fear that this speech was going to cause violence, but they then allowed that fear to be perverted for political purposes. And so it's not to excuse Adams. I don't excuse it. I do think it's the dark mark, but I do think the fear behind the act is not, cannot be dismissed either.
One of my favorite quotes, and I don't think it's apocryphal, about John Adams is from Benjamin Franklin. And no doubt you're familiar with the quote where Franklin says, "I am persuaded, however, that he means well for his country, is always an honest man, often a wise one, but sometimes, and in some things, absolutely out of his senses." Can you tell us about the character of John Adams and how that shaped his making of the presidency?
I love this quote. And in an earlier version, I'm very bad at titles. And so in an earlier version, I had thought about describing the book or titling the book An Honest Man, and then having that quote right on the inside, because I think it's so exceptional. John Adams is, I actually think, among the most accessible of the founding generation to us, because the things that we value, you know, openness, sense of humor, honesty about one's flaws, respect for women, these are all things that he had in spades. But a lot of those things that make him appealing to us in the 21st century made him an anathema to some of his contemporaries, because he didn't have the sort of marble facade that Washington did. He wasn't as good as maintaining his emotions in check or hiding them as some of the others. And so that small R Republican restraint that was so valued was not always something he was capable of doing. That being said, he had an incredible awareness of his own strengths and weaknesses. He knew what his flaws were. He could be very funny about them, very self-deprecating about them. And that was an enormous gift to him as president, because it meant that he was very careful about editing his writing. He was very careful about trying to restrain his tongue, which he knew sometimes would run away. He was very careful about checking his actions with his most important advisor, who was his wife, Abigail. His critics called her his cabinet of one, which is probably the most accurate presidential criticism ever. One other thing that I think we don't typically see as a presidential strength, but in this particular moment was essential, was he was incredibly stubborn. And he was willing, he was very independently minded. He did not see himself as a party person. And he was willing to be unpopular if he thought what he was doing was important and right. And sometimes that can get presidents into a lot of trouble if they think that they're, you know, sort of righteously indignatious and righteously stubborn. But in this case, it meant that he pursued diplomacy and he pursued peace with France on behalf of the nation, which was, I think, undoubtedly the right call, knowing that it would fracture his own party and knowing that it almost certainly would lead to his defeat in the election of 1800, because it was the right thing to do. And so that stubbornness, that independence, that willingness to kind of be a social outcast was something that was essential to his success.
And I wonder if that has shaped how we think about Adams today. You mentioned that at the beginning of our conversation. The contemporary view of John Adams, what is it, and is it on the mark, or do we have something more we need to learn?
Well, I think the contemporary view is that he was, you know, vain, he was ill-tempered, he flew off the handle, he was unreliable and unstable, and much of that language is directly quoted from the things that Hamilton and Jefferson were writing about Adams in the election of 1800 when they were competing against Adams in the election of 1800. And Adams had the very poor misfortune of living at the same time as two of the all-time greatest American propagandists, Hamilton and Jefferson. They just were extraordinarily talented. And historians typically take Jefferson and Hamilton with a grain of salt, recognizing that they're often coming at things with biases and their own motivations. And yet, for some reason, they often will quote Jefferson and Hamilton directly and assume that whatever they were saying about Adams was the perfect truth. It doesn't mean that there isn't a nugget of truth there. It doesn't mean that sometimes he couldn't have a temper and he couldn't lose his tongue. He did. But it's also really important to reflect that their descriptions of him were often because they couldn't control him or because they were trying to achieve a different political aim. And we've just come out of a political season, so we know that sometimes political commentary is not always as accurate as it could be. And I think that is certainly true of their descriptions of John Adams.
Before we go, I have to ask you this. You've had a chance to study John Adams, the man. You've studied, of course, George Washington in great depth also. What surprised you about John Adams as president?
Well, I will confess that I came in with a vision that was pretty similar to what Hamilton and Jefferson had said, because I was, you know, taking that at face value too. And so he turned out to be much more politically savvy than I anticipated. He was a much more conniving politician, I actually say with praise, not that I don't say that as a bad thing, than I anticipated. And he was much more able to pull strings and sort of move the pieces on the chessboard in a way that I did not in any way anticipate.
Lindsay, of course, we've been talking about your book, but the other thing that your other project, which I know you're underway and launching, is a wonderful new podcast. Tell us a little bit about that, because I know our listeners, who are podcast listeners, will want to tune in.
Yes, absolutely. Please do. It's called Leadership and Legacy, and it looks at leaders in the past and, you know, how they made choices, what they learned from history themselves, what we can take away from their actions to today. But it also interviews leaders that are in current positions of authority, how they've learned from history, who mattered to them. And so I'm hoping that we can provide a unique and sort of unusual dynamic in the history leadership space, and hopefully provide something that is both very entertaining and educational, but maybe also useful for those who might want to apply some of those things to their day-to-day life.
Wonderful conversation. Always great to talk about John Adams. Let me highly recommend the book to all of our listeners. It's terrific. You're going to want to pick it up and you're going to want to read it. Lindsay, thanks for taking the time to join us on The American Idea.
Well, thank you so much for having me. I really appreciate that and the warm recommendation.
Thank you for listening to this episode of The American Idea. If you enjoyed this episode, remember to subscribe at Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts, and leave a 5-star review. If you want to learn more or get involved in Ashbrook's vital work, visit our website, ashbrook.org.